IRS on the Road, value-based parenting and life balance ideas from world-traveling family coaches. Here's Richard and Linda Iyer.
Hello, and welcome back to IRS on the Road. These weeks go by so fast.
Yeah, it seems like we were just doing this yesterday.
Oh my goodness. Time goes faster as you get older, I guess. Remember when you were a little kid, it seemed like forever from Christmas to Christmas. Oh, it was forever.
Now and we just take the tree down. We got to put it back up.
Blink and it's back again. Oh my goodness.
Well,
anyway, welcome.
We're going to be lively today because our subject matter is joy and humor and another little word we're going to introduce that Linda doesn't even know about yet.
So oh, I'm excited.
I like the surprise. But we were thinking the other night about joy, which has kind of been our theme word ever since we got married. The very first book I ever wrote in my life was a book called The Discovery of Joy. Our faith teaches us that joy is the purpose of life, basically. Men are that they might have joy. And one of our grandfather's secrets that we were just working with on our grandchildren goes like this: joy is the purpose of life and a choice you make every day. And I hope that's true, although I don't know. Let me ask you, Linda, what do you think? Why are some people just sort of naturally joyful and other people just have to really work at it to conjure it up? What are the prerequisites of joy, do you think? What are the things you got to have? Or are there any? I mean, why do some people seem joyful? And joy is a deep word, deeper than happiness, as all of us know. And why do others who seem to have everything seem to have a really hard time? Is it brain chemistry?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think part of it does come with us, just like our musical abilities or our abilities to love poetry or beauty or whatever. We kind of come with some of that with us. And then, of course, circumstances of life make a big difference in joy. And even though a lot of people who were down and out and in the worst situation you can imagine still wake up feeling joy. I don't know why.
Well, and study after study shows there's no measurable connection between wealth and joy or between health and joy. I mean, you could start out by saying, well, you got to be reasonably healthy to really be joyous, or you've got to have a positive attitude to be joyous, or you've got to have, you know, enough money to live on to be joyful. But the surveys don't bear that out. I mean, there seems to be no real connection. And we were driving along the other day talking, and we thought, are we, if joy is really kind of our word, and why aren't we sort of more, you know, have we let it slip a little? Are we too serious? And that's an interesting question. How much does joy connect to humor or a light attitude and ability to be amused by things rather than crushed by them? You know, the whole question of humor. I mean, I remember, didn't you make maybe I'm mixed up on this, but didn't you once make a list of the qualities you wanted in a husband? And wasn't number one that your husband could make you laugh? Or,
well, it was sense of humor.
Those sense of humor.
Sense of humor. And I was in college. I thought that was the most important thing for a husband to have. And it is important, but there are other things that may be more important, but it really
I'm not bad at that, I have to say.
You are.
But part of it is you. You're easy. It's easy to make you laugh because you're a joyous person. And you even laugh at things that are a little bit corny.
I do sometimes.
So that makes a difference. But humor, I mean, one of our favorite writers, an actual mentor, if you will, of C.S. Lewis, a guy named G.K. Chesterton, he said a really interesting thing that bears a lot of thought. The reason the angels can fly is that they've learned to take themselves lightly.
Yeah, I love that one. I love that one because You know, we do get really bogged down with things that aren't really that important. I know you've been feeling down a little bit because you're worried about your health, and we all have these little health issues that we go through and it makes us worried. But I do have to say that really health and safety are the only two things you ever worry about. That's a pretty good
How
deal.
How do you know? Maybe I don't tell you all
deal.
My work.
I have never walked
I
out.
Worry about you a lot.
No, I know. I have never walked out the door to get in the car without you saying, drive safely, keep your eyes darting, darting. This is what we taught our kids when they were little. Keep your eyes darting, darting all the time. And it is important to be aware because we do get really sloppy when we're driving. Sometimes I do. I know most people do. But anyway, you are very, very aware of that. And I worry about other things.
Well, and I'm not even, you know, we're just sort of talking here. We're just stream of consciousness, because I'm not sure that joy and humor are always directly related. I mean, we believe joy can exist in sorrow and in lots of things as long as the proper perspective is there. And joy is a pretty deep word and sometimes kind of a sober word, But the kind of joy we were talking about the other day is the ability to take yourself lightly and to have some humor and to find amusement in things. Now, some Christians might say, well, I don't know if Jesus was laughing a lot or had a big sense of humor. I think he was pretty sober, pretty serious. I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean,
I think he had a pretty good sense of humor. I don't know how many of you have been watching The Chosen, but he does have a lovely sense of humor in that. And I mean, we don't know, but we hope that he had a lot of joy, obviously, in serving God. But I think he did have a nice sense of humor.
Well, can you find that in the scriptures themselves? I think you can in a way. I mean, if you read, try to read between the lines. And I mean, Jesus didn't tell a joke before he started the Sermon on the Mount or whatever. The goal was not humor, but some of his metaphors and some of his ways of expressing things and some of the stories and the parables, they suggest a certain kind of lightness, I think. And I mean, you know, talking about the person you shouldn't judge a mote in your neighbor's eye if you've got a beam in your own eye, like you got this big problem of your own got to deal with.
Love
or,
it.
Or the woman who wakes up at night, and I mean, there's a lot of things that sort of suggest a lightness of touch and amusement and awareness of the little ironies of life, and you can almost see him smiling as he talks about some of these things. And of course, his message was joy. I mean, the gospel, literally translated, is the good news. It's hard not to be happy or joyful if you're giving the greatest news of all time, right?
Right. There's a saying that goes, though, for mothers, that you are only as happy as your saddest child or something like
no,
that.
No, that's good. Yeah.
I mean, if you have a child that's in trouble, you just can't be happy. And I understand what they're saying by that, because it is really, it's a deep seated thing that you, it's that in the back of your head all the time, like, what can I do for this child? How can I make things better? And the answer is really, they have to make things better. I mean, you can do little things that help, but it really is so important to remember that we need to get past those really dark, dreary feelings. And remember that there is so much joy to be grasped in life, even just from nature. I mean, especially from nature.
Yeah.
And from things that are outside of ourselves.
So that's the real question. Can joy and even humor, even lightness, exist in a really serious situation, whether it's personal or larger than personal? I mean, like you say, how do you be joyful? How do you have a sense of humor? How do you be light in your mind and in your heart if you have a child who's gravely ill, or if you have a friend who's had a terrible time, or if your own health is is problematic and so on. I think, you know, one of the people who tried to answer that really deep, sometimes dark question was a man named Viktor Frankl, who wrote an incredible book called Man's Search for Meaning.
I love that book.
And he, I mean, his frame of reference is that he was in a prisoner of war and he was Jewish and in a concentration camp and was actually being used for medical experimentation. I mean, can you imagine any more dire circumstance than that? And yet his whole idea was, you can choose. You can choose whether you hate the Nazis who are persecuting you. You can choose whether you feel complete discouragement in the circumstance you're in, or whether you, I remember one of his examples, he lived in a little cell and couldn't see nature, which he loved, but he could see the sky. And that one little square of sky was enough to give him joy, or to say, I choose to focus on the beauty of the sky.
Yes.
And rather than on what's happening to
you. You know, Nelson Mandela, when we went out to his island where he was in that horrible prison for a while, his story is he wanted just one little plot of green.
Yeah, just one little thing.
With a tree or plant of some kind, anyway, that could just give him a little bit of joy while he was there in that horrid place. We went in and saw the cells are 3x4. I mean, they were just tiny. Yeah. They let him out, I don't know, even once a day to at least get in the air. But wow, what a guy.
And it's interesting you mentioned South Africa and Nelson Mandela, because in the second half of the show, we're going to talk a little about something Desmond Tutu said, who was the bishop of South Africa and who grew up on the same street as Nelson Mandela in the ghetto of apartheid South Africa. So there's going to be some connections in the second half. But what a lot of people think, and I'm partial to this, I think, Linda, is that it is the Spirit of God that cuts through all the circumstances. The Holy Ghost, the Spirit of God, I believe, we believe, is a happy spirit, a joyful spirit, not in the trivial sense of the word, but in the deep sense of the word, and allows us to see things in perspective and to find little moments of joy, even in hard times, and to have a certain lightness of attitude, like the angels can fly because they take yourself lightly, to find the little moments of either humor or relief or joy or emotion. Our youngest daughter sent us a song today that she'd listened to that gave her joy, and she said made her cry, and we were just crying a little right before we started listening to her song. So it's moments, isn't it? It's about moments. Joy doesn't come in vast swaths. I'm happy now for the next year completely all the time. Every
I just
minute.
Had such a good time.
It's moments.
So with that,
you always talk about moments.
Yeah, I do talk about moments because they're sometimes few and far between. Sometimes they just come at you so fast that you don't know what to do with all of them. But we hope you can just do a little thinking about your own joy level and do that for a minute while we have a little break.
We're going to come right back and introduce you to an African word that might help in this pursuit of joy.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Iyer's on the Road. Here's Richard and Linda Iyer.
And we're back talking about joy, maybe the happiness or joy. You know, there was a study that started in 1890 of men. And I don't have details, but I just do remember learning about this in a class that we did once. It really was amazing. They studied men, their degree of happiness. Happiness was, I mean, joy and happiness are kind of going along. And they've been doing it since 1890.
The Harvard study.
Harvard
grads, yeah.
And, I mean, to men that were 90 and 95 and so on, they just kept keeping track of them. And they've found that the ones that feel that they were really happy, that had some joy in their lives, lived longer, were happier, obviously, but they really lived longer.
They focused on relationships.
They focused on relationships.
That was the key.
Yeah.
Well, let's look a little further afield at this question, and we're going to read you a little from something we read almost every day, namely Father Rohr, Richard Rohr. And I've read this. Linda hasn't. So this is going to be interesting because you're going to discover it along with Linda. So if we were able to see ourselves in other people, our experience in the world will inevitably be richer, kinder, more connected. If we look at others and see ourselves reflected back, we inevitably treat people better. And we've said on this show before, the key to relationships is looking into people's eyes and seeing inside of them, seeing into their hearts, really seeing them, seeing what they feel. But the even greater gift is to be able to see out, back out through their eyes and see you as they see you and see the world as they see it. It's like people are a crystal ball. If you can get inside their brain, you have a whole new paradigm to see the world.
Love that. I'm going to a lunch today. I'm going to look at those people and try to figure out what I see of myself in them and what they might see in the world around them. That's really great.
Okay, now here's what gets exciting, Linda. I'm excited to see your reaction to this. Okay. What we're talking about, this empathy, this deep being able to see in and out of people, there's an African word, and it's an incredible word, Ubuntu. Or Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U.
You better say the U the same all three times, Ubuntu.
Ubuntu. So we're going to read you a little of this and see if you're as fascinated as we are.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, we'll alternate.
The first
here.
Time.
Yeah, we'll alternate.
Ubuntu shouldn't be confused with kindness, however. Kindness is something we might try to show more of, but Ubuntu goes much deeper. It recognizes the inner worth of every human being, starting with yourself.
Ubuntu tells us we are only who we are thanks to other people. Of course, we have our parents to credit for bringing us into the world, but beyond this, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of relationships, big and small, along the way, which teach us something about life and how to live it. Our parents and guardians teach us how to walk and talk. Our teachers at school teach us how to read and write. Our mentor might help us find fulfilling work. A lover might teach us emotional lessons, both good and bad. We learn from all experiences. Every interaction will have brought us to where we are. So Ubuntu is a difficult worldview for many Westerners, who tend to understand self as over or against others, or as in competition with others. We talked a lot about competition a couple of weeks ago on this podcast. In a Western worldview, interdependence may easily be confused with codependence, which is a pathological condition in which people share a dependence on something that is not life-giving, such as alcohol or drugs. Ubuntu, however, is about symbiotic and cooperative relationships. Neither the parasitic and destructive relationships of codependence nor the draining and alienating relationships of competition. Now, Desmond Tutu, who we mentioned in the first half and who we once spoke on the same program with, an incredible, wonderful, tiny little man with great wisdom. Here's what he said about Ubuntu.
Ubuntu. The person with Ubuntu is open and available to others, affirming of others, does not feel threatened that others are able and good, for he or she has a proper self-assurance that comes from knowing that he or she belongs in a greater whole and is diminished when others are humiliated or diminished.
So isn't that the opposite of competition?
Absolutely.
Ubuntu, where we see that we are interdependent, that we're all in this together, that we become from each other, and that relationships is what fulfills us, and so on. So carry on with that.
Our planet cannot survive if we define our identity only through competition. If I know myself as strong only because someone else is weak, if I know myself as a Black person only because someone else is white, then my identity depends on a perpetual competition that only leaves losers. I love that. If I know myself as a man only by dominating women, if I know myself as a Christian only because someone else is going to hell, then both my masculinity and my Christianity are devoid of content.
So do you like this Beautiful. Concept of Ubuntu? It's pretty great, isn't it? So rather than reinforcing competitive ways of knowing self, which is really sort of the Western way, it's not so true in Eastern thinking, thank goodness. But rather than reinforcing competitive ways of knowing self, Ubuntu offers a way of discovering self-identity through interdependence. As such, it is possible to argue that my very salvation is dependent on yours. Radical stuff for Western ears to hear, but vital to the survival of the earth.
Ooh, that is a beautiful article. My goodness. It reminds me of another one of our favorite words, namaste, which is an Indian word, which means when you meet someone, you look at them in the eye and you say, I see the divine spark in you. I see it. I see it. And if you're looking for it, you can always see it. It's amazing. And as soon as they start talking, or whether they're sorrowful or happy or whatever, as soon as you see that divine spark, you see a little bit of yourself in there, but then you just start loving them for who they are and not for what they look like or anything else surrounding them. It's a beautiful word.
And doesn't it tie into, and you're always saying this, and you're frankly, you're the master of it, Linda, is that service, when you're serving someone else, you slip into a kind of happiness that's sort of always available to you because your mind is off of yourself and your own problems or ailments or pains or whatever, and onto this other person who you're really, I mean, when you're serving someone or a group of people, but particularly when you're serving an individual, you have an empathy because that's the only way to serve them. I mean, it is the crystal ball of another person. I mean, you have your worldview and everything that's in your brain, and now you're trying to help this other person, trying to understand them, trying to see them, trying to see into them, and trying even to see out through their eyes how the rest of the world looks. And this is so expanding that you forget about your own woes and you begin to feel a kind of happiness. Now, that's not a great explanation because no one quite can explain why. And we've got hymns in the songbook at church. We've got sermons. We've got so much wisdom that tells us you don't become happy by seeking happiness for yourself. You find it by seeking happiness for others. And then suddenly you have the byproduct of joy and of being happy. But this, I just love this Ubuntu, the idea that we are all connected and we are all interdependent. I mean, that's one of the reasons we did a book, or I did not long ago, about the fallacy of independence, the fact that we'd all like to think we're independent, and we call independence, we associate it with democracy and with freedom and all these other things. But in actual fact, we're completely interdependent on each other. And in our view, we're dependent on God. And those things don't rob us of happiness and joy. They enhance it. They give it to us even more. But service, I think, is what you... I think that's a big source of your happiness, honey.
Well, I think for all mothers it is. I mean, we're service machines.
We do. Whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not. And it never ends because your children grow up and you still feel like you love them and adore them, but you need to do what you can to serve them and grandchildren as well, maybe even more because they are one step removed, but maybe they need us more. I do think that it's just really a good thought. Ubuntu, I'm going to remember that at lunch today because I'm going to be with several women that I know and some that I don't know at all. And one that I know is really down and out right now. Mm. Her mother just passed away. And I'm going to go with a different tack, not just chit-chatting, but really finding out how people feel.
And try to
really
see into
see
her.
See that spark.
And then maybe you'll even see out through her eyes.
Yeah.
I think that's powerful. And before we end, I mean, as long as we're on these wonderful words, you mentioned namaste, and we've been talking about Ubuntu. We ought to also mention our Japanese word that we've been fascinated with lately, because it ties into joy. Is it misogi?
Misogi. It's like miso soup, but misogi.
Which means?
Just being quiet, being introspective, being silent. We're just studying it now, and we have wonderful new neighbors who are from Japan. They just came about maybe 2 months ago, but they are born and raised and bred Japanese. The wife is, her father was some kind of a king or something, or grandfather, maybe it was, in that culture. But that culture is so fabulous. They think so quietly and they think so deeply.
But isn't misogi also challenging yourself, doing really hard, hard things, which then make the rest of your life seem more joyful?
I don't know. I hope so.
Well, like Isaac said, that was his misogi. One of our grandsons just climbed the highest mountain in Bali, which is a big volcano. And he said, this was my misogi. This was my once a year, I'm going to do something really, really hard, so hard that I don't even know if I'll live through it, because that will put the rest of my life in perspective.
Well, he was climbing the highest mountain in Bali, which I don't think is really high, but
well, it's a volcano.
It's rocky, crazy. It's
crazy.
A volcano.
Yeah.
And he went not knowing anyone else on purpose so that he could be quiet with himself and then just soak in people. He's an amazing young man.
He really is. And that was his misogi experience.
He
loved it. But it was also because it was calm and quiet, but also extremely challenging, right?
Yes. So
I invite you to explore that word, because we're not experts on any of these words, but namaste, an Indian word. Misogi, a Japanese word.
Ubuntu.
And Ubuntu, a sub-Saharan African word. We don't have all the words we need in English.
Yeah, I've thought that so many times. I'm so tired of using wonderful, beautiful, extraordinary. There's got to be a better word. Astonishing.
More specific
word. I'm trying to think. And I like to look in the dictionary, and really, there's only about 10 words. And there's got to be more words. I agree. These are beautiful.
And
we're
dumb Americans who only speak one language. So we
well,
don't have the
probably,
benefit
maybe
of some of these.
Speak a lot of languages.
I'm talking about you and me.
And I,
But, you know, we'll end with that as a lighter note, because we're talking about humor and joy, right? So what do you call a person that speaks three languages? Well, they're trilingual. Mm-hmm. What do you call a person that speaks two? Well, they're bilingual. What do you call a person that only speaks one language? An American.
It's truer than we like to think. Although, wow, as our culture improved in our community and our church group, we have so many people from different countries now. I love that. So we hope that you feel a little more joy and humor. We should have had some jokes ready.
I tried at the end. And you think most of mine are corny anyway, but you still laugh.
Yes, I still laugh. And there are some things that happen that are just so funny. And I'm just trying to think of one that I could not forget, but I forgot.
And we're out of time, so it's a good thing. We love all of you. Thanks for listening to Ayers on the Road. And
we'll see you next time. Thanks for joining. Bye-bye.